810 now, good morning. Well, the Summit County Council and Summit Land Conservancy can't agree on the easements for the Oscar Thorpe Family Ranch there on Old Ranch Road, putting the purchase of the conservation easement of this property at risk. In the studio with an update, Cheryl Fox with Summit Land Conservancy. Good morning.
Good morning.
So what the news on the Oscar Thorpe Ranch, not good, huh?
Yeah, not really great. Well, there's some good and some not good. The good is we actually have an opportunity to control our destiny on this piece of property. And I think, Leslie, you and most of your listeners understand how rare that is. Usually we're fighting a rear guard action. Usually neighbors are trying to get petitions to say, keep the density off, move the development away, take the density away. In this situation, we are fortunate in that we have a willing landowner that has come to the table that says, I want to keep the farm a farm. This is consistent with the Snyderville Basin General Plan, which says we should do everything we can to actually work with landowners to keep the farm a farm. And, you know, at this point, the landowner has offered to reduce the purchase price by 20% off fair market value. The landowner has offered public access, and when the initial offer of public access wasn't deemed, or you know, we were told that they didn't like that, we offered a different kind of public access. And, you know, we're also bringing, at this point, $9.2 million to the table in cash. And the county has said that's completely unacceptable. So,
but what's the sticking point? Is it the 10-foot easement that Summit County is looking for?
We have gone back to them and said, how about this, how about that, to try to address what the county is looking for. They have said we need 30-foot wide easements all around the perimeter. They want an 85-foot setback from the Old Ranch Road. I think, you know, they are looking to exact some solutions to issues at the Canyon Spa agreement. So, you know, they've asked for a number of things that don't really have anything to do with the saving the farm as a farm, and some that actually make it would impact our federal dollars. Like, we would have to walk away from between $1 and $2 million federal dollars to accommodate the trails all around the perimeter. And the county has not offered a way to make up that money, if you will.
Well, why can't you just move forward and then just hope for the best?
We are moving forward. Thank you very much. We are going to focus on the deal at hand, which is, I mean, it's a pretty amazing that we got this federal money. It's pretty amazing that we have a landowner who's willing to put himself, the family, through this process. You know, it's a lot. Nobody criticizes anyone for putting a for sale sign up. And for some reason, you know, people are like, well, we're so lucky that we have this landowning family. We would not have what we call now the McPolin Farm, the big white barn that's the iconic picture of Park City. We would not have that as protected open space if the family had not worked with Park City and saved it. So let's focus on the deal at hand. We can save this. We've got most of the money in hand. We can control our destiny. We're going to save the view. We're going to save the heritage of this farm. But we need, you know, we've raised $500,000, so we need another $5 million.
All right. So, again, moving forward with the deal means that we don't get what the county's asking for in terms of the easements.
Unfortunately, that's true. If the county doesn't bring money to the table, you know, it's hard for us to expect the landowner to provide all of those kinds of public amenities and benefits. I mean, so I think that it's really important at this point that people take an opportunity to really, vote with your pocketbook. You can go to wesaveland.org and make contributions. I think if we can go back maybe to the county and say, wow, look at the public support we've got in terms of real hard dollars, maybe the county will reconsider.
How long do you get to raise the, what is it, $5.5 million now?
$5 million left, mm-hmm. Till March. So we've got a pretty fast deadline. So we are, you know, people can call our office, go to wesaveland.org. All of our numbers and things are there. You can find my email address and things like that if people would like to get more involved. You know, we are encouraging people to write letters to the editor so that they, you know that this the farm is not saved. There was a rumor going around that, you know, because we raised all this federal money that it was done. It's not done. We have to raise matching dollars. The federal money does not come without local money. So we have to raise the local money, too.
Okay. So what happens if we don't raise the $5 million? Then a for sale sign goes up on the property?
A for sale sign goes up on the property.
Because the family has to raise some
funds. The family has an obligation that they have to meet, due to, a death in the family a few years ago and some entanglements that way in that estate. And so they do. They have a big obligation that was, in essence, willed to them. I just think we're so fortunate that they decided to try to save their farm and solve their problem instead of just up and selling it. Because then, if they had just up and sold it, we'd be looking at a developer coming in and maybe how often do developers come in at base density? Let's think about that one too. Not very often. So, we would be playing a catch-up game. We would be trying to get things, it makes sense to a certain extent to exact concessions from a developer who is coming here to benefit from our community. In a situation like this, where you've got longtime community members, people who live here, whose children live here. You've got neighbors who have expressed an interest. We have a bond that says, and a general plan that says we should save this land. I think we should save this land. So the Summit Land Conservancy is out. We're raising money. We need a lot of it. We certainly hope that people will come out and help us, save this money, use the federal money. We're leveraging our dollars over and over and over again. We have an amazing opportunity, but we need everybody to come out and help us match it.
All right. And again, if you don't, the base density on that is what?
Between 7 and 15 homes.
Okay. We're talking about how many acres?
158.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Cheryl, anything else?
People can also, it's Live PC, Give PC this weekend. I would encourage everybody to support KPCW because they help all the rest of us. If you are going to make a contribution to the Summit Land Conservancy, you can write Osgathorpe or the farm on it, and we can't designate that to that money, but to that cause, but we can certainly count it as people voting for the farm.
So, okay. Cheryl,
help
thanks.
Us out. Thank you.
KPCW News Time now, 8:08. Summit County Council meets tomorrow, starting bright and early at 9:30 with a site visit to the Red Pine Road, then lunch at Stein Erickson Lodge for the Park City Chamber Bureau's Fall Forum, then back to the Sheldon Richens Building at 2:30 for a work session in the studio with a rundown of the agenda. And filling in for County Manager Tom Fisher, I have Caroline Rodriguez. Good morning.
Good morning.
So Tom on vacation?
Nope, he's on Army business.
Okay. Well, let's just start with the transit topics on the agenda that you're most familiar with.
Sure.
A report on the e-bike share program is now ending for winter months. Does the report actually say that this is the most successful bike share launch in U.S. history?
It doesn't say it's the most successful in U.S. history. It's the most successful electric bike launch in terms of ridership and the bikes that were used and the levels of ridership that we saw. And that's not an exaggeration. We had over 32,000 miles ridden.
All right. Well, let's talk a little more about the stats then. 32,000 miles.
Mm-hmm.
What else?
I think it's close to 13,000 rides, about 5,000 unique members that use the bikes.
All right. And then in terms of money, I mean, was it a money losing proposition?
I have not done the calculations, but for the county, it's not a money losing proposition because we don't pay any ongoing maintenance or operations costs. So for us, it was successful. If we're talking about taking, 32,000 miles worth of trips off the road, of course that's successful for us.
Okay. What we do pay for was just the installation and
yes.
The bikes themselves.
Yes, the bikes and the stations. Yep. And then we're going to see, residents will see in the off season, we're going to have significant upgrades to all of the stations and the bikes. Or maybe they won't see it, but they will notice it come spring.
Okay. When do things open back up once the snow's gone?
Yep. So probably end of May.
All right.
Date to be determined.
All right. And then in terms of how much we have spent to date, any idea what that number is?
Still under 500,000.
Okay. And coming up in terms of improvements that you're proposing? We're talking about some staffing. What would this look like?
Yep. So our bike share operator is adding additional full-time staff, including a dedicated project manager, which we did not have before. We shared with other share systems across the country. We are going to be upgrading the charging station. So part of the issues we saw with the bikes is that because people wanted to use them, they weren't docked long enough to get a full charge on each bike. So our bike vendor is free of charge, adding additional charging units to the existing docks so that the bikes can charge much quicker, so they don't have to be docked as long.
Okay. And then in terms of replacement parts and inspections, that...
Mm-hmm. Yep. So we worked with Park City to develop a detailed inspection checklist, and that will go into effect whereby our operator on the street will have a checklist to go through every day to look at the bikes and the stations, and that will include checking the brakes, checking the charge, checking the payment kiosks to make sure everything is working there. And then we have also asked our vendor to have a full cache of spare parts on hand locally so that we don't get caught up in this, well, parts are caught in customs, we can't get them onto the street. You need to have a backlog of those parts available.
All right. In terms of adding to the fleet, I think we had 88. We're going to add how many?
That is also to be determined. We're adding at least 10 because our operator has agreed to add around 10% of additional bikes of whatever we pay for free of charge. And then if Park City or Summit County, you know, we're going to go through in the next couple of months and look at if we want to buy more bikes.
All right. And in terms of upgrading the abandoned bike protocol, how what are you talking about? And so, this is when something breaks down. And
exactly. So the bike share operator did have a system in place for identifying broken down bikes or abandoned bikes. But because they were so short staffed, there was nobody monitoring it 24/7. And then it turned out that we as, you know, local staff would get calls or emails about the bikes. So from now on, they have a dedicated staff person to monitor exactly that when a bike is left for more than 6 hours, and then they will dispatch someone to pick it up. Local staff will also have access to the IT platform that displays the alert. So if for some reason the vendor is really busy, then for example, I would see on my dashboard that a bike has been left for more than 6 hours, and I can send a text to our local project manager and say, you need to dispatch someone to get that bike.
All right. What complaints did you get about the bike share, and how are you going to address those?
So I think, you know, the biggest complaint we got is, number one, that there were no bikes available, or number two, that I took out a bike and it didn't work. The electric pedal assist didn't work, and that was directly tied to charging. So as I said, we're adding the additional charging units, and we hope that will address that complaint. We went through 10 pages of upgrades that we're working on, and we have a detailed action plan for when and how all of those changes will be implemented. And I'm really, really excited, and I feel really positive about the direction the program's going.
Okay. Second item on the agenda is the Valley to Mountain Study under the Mountain Accord or Wasatch Commission. Now, the alternatives analysis seems to be focused on the 224 corridor right now. The report that you've written says that you've been getting public input online since September, huh?
Yes. Yes. And I know Alfred spoke a little bit about that project yesterday, but this is just our opportunity to update my council on where that project is, remind them that there's a public input session going on online right now, and then we do have that public open house scheduled for early December.
Okay. Do you have the date on December?
December 5th, I believe. Yep.
Okay. And that's going to be where?
It's going to be at Park City Library.
All right. So we're looking at three options for 224. I'm talking about a bus rapid transit lanes or a light rail transit lanes?
Yes. And that one is center running or both sides running or I believe west side running.
Okay. What makes the most sense?
You know, I'm waiting to see. I want to see all the public comment. I haven't had a chance to dig into the environmental constraints. You know, there's pros and cons to each. We don't want people, you know, dashing across the road to get to center running lanes or stations. So to be determined, and that's the point of this project, is to determine what the locally preferred alternative is.
Okay. Real quick, just wanted to note that Council will be holding another public hearing on the Canyon Spa Amendment. Does anything in this approval relate at all to what you do?
Yes, it does in terms of the traffic and transportation mitigation plan. I think what's most important to remember about this public open house is that this is the same spa amendment that we've been working on for a year. So if people are interested and have been paying attention to what went through Planning Commission and has also been in a council work session, this is not new information. This is just the first public hearing. So definitely download the staff report, and there's a lot of information in there.
Okay. That happens at 6 o'clock.
6 p.m.
Mm-hmm. Now, what happens if the hearing attracts a big crowd? Where do they park?
Well, we have 38 additional parking spaces at Richens now. You can enter on the backside of Richens or through the existing Richens parking lot to the left of where the bookmobile is usually parked.
Okay. And this amended plan envisions more than 1,100 pillows for employees in the Lower Village. How is this going to impact the traffic on 224?
You know, I have not been involved in the last 3 months, obviously, so I can't speak to that. I know they are working on revisiting the traffic mitigation plan.
Well, we should note that you've been out on maternity leave.
Yes. Yeah,
that's right. You haven't been there. And then in terms of the assessment district that the Canyons plan envisions, that's to provide some off-site parking?
Once again, I'm sorry, I can't speak to that right now. Things have changed so quickly while I've been out.
Okay.
I don't know. I'm sorry.
All right. And then real quick, Summit County is going to be hosting a legislative reception. This is
yes.
Just invited. Everybody's invited?
Yep. That's 4 to 6 p.m. Thursday in Colville.
Okay. Courthouse there?
Yes.
Council chambers?
Yes.
Okay. And it's just really an update with our legislative?
Yes, that's correct.
Folks? Mm-hmm. Okay. Attending are Representative Logan Wild, Representative Tim Quinn, and Senator Kevin Van Tassel, and Senator Alan Christensen.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And if people have questions, they can contact Jana Young in our office.
Okay. Caroline, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Caroline Rodriguez with Summit County. KPCW News Time, 8:31. Well, the Park City Planning Commission meeting tomorrow night starting at 5:30 in the City Council chambers of the Marsac Building. In the studio with the rundown, I have Planning Director Bruce Erickson. Good morning.
Good morning.
Real quick, the National Ability Center's request for its expansion plans will be continued. Just what, not ready at this point?
They're pretty ready. What we're trying to do is make sure that all the previous agreements are in place and that they have the ability to do this. The site is in recreation open space zone, and so some of the things they want to do are consistent with that zone, but we brought them over from the county in a specially planned area, and so we're trying to make all the paperwork align and make sure that they can move forward. So no issues, just trying to get it cleaned up and ready to go.
So do we know that the additional density will be allowed?
All the uses they're asking for right now are consistent with the specially planned area. If they bring forward additional athlete housing, that's what we're going to be looking at next when we amend their master plan.
Okay, November 29th, that
right.
Comes back. All right. Let's see, treasurer meeting, so that's the bulk of tomorrow's meeting.
Oh, yeah.
Spoke with Pat Sweeney, the applicant, last week. He says he expects a decision will be made by the end of the year. You agree with that?
I don't know. It's up to the Planning Commission right now. Both sides are establishing their positions. This is as far as this project has ever gotten since 1985. And so you can see in the city staff report to the Planning Commission, we're starting to make some determinations for the Planning Commission to discuss, some recommendations moving forward. You'll see on the city website the applicant's position with respect to the positions we're taking. We're down in the weeds a little bit talking about details and whether we interpreted something correctly for the Planning Commission or whether the Planning Commission is going to be asked to make a different determination. So really, really, Leslie, I encourage everybody to go to the website, see what the applicant is saying, see what the staff is saying, see what the other groups are saying as well, and triangulate where they think the outcome is going to be.
Yeah, in that interview last week, Pat Sweeney said that he thinks that they have gone above and beyond what would be required by any other applicant looking for a conditional use permit.
I'm not sure that the Planning Commission shares that opinion. On a biweekly basis, they keep asking for more information and more details. The analogy that we would use is And this isn't probably a perfect one, but basically if you ask your children if they did their homework, the answer is yes, Mom, I did my homework. Do you drill down and say, did you actually do everything you're supposed to do, or did you just do your homework? And so the applicant is taking the position that they've given us everything they've asked for. The Planning Commission is taking the position, well, we need more detail, more precision in what you're telling us, because this is a conditional use permit. This is not a master plan development that can go on and on and on and on and have subsequent review. This is the last step before building permit.
All right. Well, Sweeney also mentioned that the city had had the opportunity to purchase the property for dimes on the dollar, and it's become certainly a point of contention in the mayor's race. But who did that valuation? Do we know? I mean, was it an independent appraiser hired by both Park City and the Sweeneys?
Well, I don't know. I suspect that it's like a lot of things around here. It's part urban myth, it's part discussion, and it's part actual fact. So there may have been a half a dozen discussions since 85 on this. We did make a property transaction with the Sweeneys back when the town list was being approved. The ground that you see above us here before you get into Creole Gulch is actually city-owned open space.
Okay. During the October 25th meeting, the Planning Commission requested, as you've mentioned, a number of items to be addressed. Maybe we can just run through a few of those. The construction staging timeline hasn't been submitted. Have you seen anything on that?
Oh, we have not seen anything on that yet.
Okay. What about all of those items listed in the Planning Commission? Have you – there? Just still waiting? Or
the applicant has submitted some additional information late Friday afternoon. I haven't had a chance to do a complete review. Neither is Planner Astorga. I think the construction staging timeline probably isn't at the level of deep detail that the construction folks on the Planning Commission are interested in. And I really think the crux issue is not 5 years after the start of construction. The crux issue is, what does that first year look like? And how are all these things going to take place when the areas of laydown and all those other things aren't ready to go? And nobody's had a chance to test the mitigation strategies, right? The year one is going to be a beta test for everything the applicant is committed to do.
With regard to employee housing, then, that was another one of the items that the commission was looking for. What is the requirement on that?
Well, said simply, given the size of the project at its current level and probably not drilled down to version 17.2, the applicant is required to provide about 22,000 square feet, of employee housing on the site. They met with the housing board in 2007, which is the city council, and they were pretty clear that these things had to be on site. The applicant contends the outcome of that meeting was that they could pay a fee in lieu, and they're only putting 7,000 square feet on site. So the staff has made a discussion for the Planning Commission to review of about 22,000 square feet on site. The applicant is saying, no, we're going to be about 7,000 square feet on site.
Has that fee been paid?
I mean, No. That fee wouldn't be paid until we go to platting. But the applicant has commented to the Planning Commission, if you put another 22,000 square feet on site, you just add volume to the project. That discussion needs to take place with the Planning Commission and ultimately the Housing Authority.
All right. Let's see. In terms of kind of the missing documents, have we figured out what these mean? And we found all of the documents that need to be found?
Yes and no, Leslie. I mean, these are not necessarily found documents. The planning staff is trying to be as rigorous as they are every time we go through a Deer Valley MPD or a St. Regis MPD. We end up having to go all the way back, making sure the records are always in alignment as best we can. And that research is ongoing. The applicant submitted some additional information on Friday night, including the original deed of sale between the original owners and the Sweeney brothers, giving them the right to place some fill material in the ski runs. There's some other information coming forward from the Sweeneys. So there's some deep, dark, dusty boxes underneath the parking garage of the golf course that some of our folks are down looking for. So, for example, I've asked my team to go look for the 8 alternatives that were proposed that resulted in the Sweeney Master Plan in the 85-86. So we know what was there, and we can tell the Planning Commission what the deliberations were. They haven't been found yet. I don't know whether Sweeney's have got them or not, but we're going to continue to look.
Yeah, Pat says that the planning staff is misinterpreting what the documents say.
Well, that's fine. I mean, that's what the Planning Commission is supposed to determine. Is, you know, this is a debate, and you have to go on the preponderance of compliance with the code. And if you don't have enough information to determine that compliance, then the Planning Commission has to make one decision or the other. And I think, you know, in the longer term discussion of these things, the conditional use permit requires mitigation strategies to reduce the impact of any one of the 15 criteria. Mitigation consists of three basic tools. One is avoid the impact. Second, minimize the impact. And third, minimize the consequences of not being able to accomplish the first two. And so the Planning Commission is on that cusp of give us enough information to make sure that you're minimizing the impact to the greatest degree possible, consistent with the code, and then talk to us about the mitigation strategies for those things you can't minimize and avoid. So that's the discussion the Planning Commission is going to hear on every one of the things that the applicant has put forward.
One of the other things, the retaining walls with regard to those cliffscapes, that was as a result of the excavation
right.
that needed to be done. They, at one point, were said to be outside of the allowable footprint of the development. Where are we with those?
That discussion is brought forward to the Planning Commission as well. We, the staff is taking the position to the Planning Commission that the body of evidence on what building area is supposed to be and limits of disturbance supposed to be and the other criteria from the 85 master plan suggests that no permanent structures are outside of the building boundary and into the recreation open space zone. So in terms of the way the master plan works, the criteria was that the final limits of disturbance were going to be determined at conditional use stage. And we are interpreting that to say that, yes, we're going to determine that they are consistent with the master plan. So at this point, the walls are out and the Planning Commission is going to have to decide the effect of that.
Okay. Anything else you think we should note?
No, I just encourage everybody to go to the website and drill down on some of the information. The public has been really good at reading and listening and learning, and the Planning Commission as well, and the applicant is doing the best they can.
Okay. Bruce
Erickson.
Thank
you, Leslie.
Thank you. Well, this month's free lunch and learn at the PC Mark will focus on dyslexia awareness. Joining me now in the studio, Cole Johnson with the PC Mark, along with Elisa Eaton from PC Reads. Good morning.
Morning, Leslie.
Cole, we'll let you start. Just when and where?
Yeah, we are excited about this one. Tomorrow at the PC Mark from 12 to 1 p.m. Right there in the party room. We're excited to introduce our guest speaker, Elisa Eaton.
Okay. And so, Elisa, you're going to be focusing on dyslexia.
Yes. Good yeah. morning.
So who should be there?
I think anyone who wants to learn more. You know, this is a topic that really affects all of us because dyslexia affects everyone. And with it being up to 1 in 5 individuals, most of us likely know somebody who is dyslexic, whether they realize they're dyslexic or not, or you realize it.
Yeah. Well, I remember when you first started your organization, it was done in part because you didn't feel like you were getting the attention that you needed from the school district. It seems like that's changing.
Yes. We're very thankful for the changes. And that's one thing that I will also talk about tomorrow is the Dyslexia Initiative in Park City, what that looked like last year, what it looks like this year, and what we hope it will continue to look like in the years to come.
Yeah. So what kind of help do you think that the school district is offering now that it didn't? That's really made some strides.
Right. So one of the major parts of the Dyslexia Initiative was the implementation of Wilson Foundations in classrooms this year. So last year it was a pilot at McPolin. This year all K through 2 classrooms are being instructed 20 to 30 minutes a day explicitly in reading through Wilson Foundations. So every child will have that effective reading instruction to begin with. And then the next step is to really identify those who are struggling and provide further intervention.
Right. So it used to be an issue of, you know, testing, whether or not to find out whether you can diagnose a kid with dyslexia. Is that, we don't need that anymore? Or
no, I think there's still definitely a need. One thing that's built into Wilson Foundations is some progress monitoring. So the teachers are testing more regularly now just in the classroom on basic reading skills. However, for the student who's struggling, which I think the teachers will be able to see more clearly now, then the school district does have a responsibility to assess that student to find out why they are struggling.
Yeah. I think the stigma around dyslexia also making huge strides. I mean, it used to be, you know, a kid, you know, just wasn't smart, you know, when he or she struggled with reading. Now I think what we've learned over the time is that really bright people have dyslexia. And so it's really while it may be very difficult early on, it's now being considered some kind of gift.
Yes. And I think and I think some people would still hesitate to call it a gift just because there are those struggles when they're young. But yes, the acknowledgement and the awareness is making even kids feel better about knowing that they're dyslexic. And that's one thing that our Mind Youth program also is helping with, is where we bring kids together so they can see they're not alone in this. And the younger kids can meet older high school students who are very successful in school even. And the self-esteem can be built, because that's one of the biggest issues when a child does find out that they have a learning difference.
Yeah. And I guess what I hear from dyslexics is that the struggle never ends. They just figure out ways to work around it, because it just means a lot more work than
exactly
without it.
Yeah. And like you said, there are, you know, a lot of creative people are dyslexic. A lot of Olympian athletes may be dyslexic. So in highlighting those who have been super successful is really beneficial to the young students too.
Okay. Anything else you want to mention?
Sure. Live PC is Friday, as everyone knows. So thank you, KPCW, and we hope people will be supportive of KPCW. I know the Mark has a donation station Friday morning as well. So thank you to the Mark. And please remember Live PC Reads and come tomorrow.
Okay. We'll see you. Thank you.
Thank you, Leslie.
As we have watched the devastating fires in Santa Rosa, Northern California last month, we thought it would be a good time to update our fire situation this past summer. In the studio, I have Park City Fire Chief Paul Hewitt along with Fire Marshal Mike Owens. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So overall, Paul, we lucked out. No wildfires really to speak of here in the district?
Yeah, part of it's luck. I mean, if you're looking at lightning strike caused fires, that would definitely be luck. But I say another big part of it, we did have our fair share of starts here in Summit County, and we were able to extinguish them very quickly. We do suppress Mother Nature a lot of the time, especially here in Park City. So we have a lot of capabilities, but luck does weigh into it. But I like to think of it as we're doing a lot of the things we should be doing with suppression. We can improve, though.
Yeah. Are those recommendations that you make and follow up on then?
Yeah, such as the 30-foot defensible space that we talk about all the time around all of the structures here. And I understand, you know, back in the day it was recommended that there was actually a clear-cut 30-foot zone around homes. But that has been altered to some degree. Now you prune your trees, you try to plant fire-resistant plants in that zone, and you make sure that no branches or trees or shrubs are actually touching your house, because that helps fire spread very quickly. And it's very hard for us to fight a fire if you've got fuels touching and they kind of become the structure.
So is it really just a matter of time, though?
Is it a matter of time? Well, it's definitely a matter of time for starts. But I'm not the fire chief that says it's a matter of time before we have a massive fire. We will do everything we can. We have a very capable fire district, and we will be very aggressive. There's not a person in our fire district that can't pull a hose straight up a mountain. We can, from a street, we can fight fire 1,500 to 2,000 feet from the roadway. So a matter of time before we have a massive fire like California, I don't want to go there. We're gonna suppress Mother Nature.
Yeah. So, Mike, when we look at what happened in San Jose, I mean, could something like that ever happen here?
Oh, that's a dangerous question. You can't say yes or no to that one. There certainly is the possibility that we can have a giant wildfire here. There are some big, big differences between what we have here and what they had there. If you start, you look at the fuels that we have. Our sagebrush is a little different from theirs, but more than anything else are the winds. They have winds that are sustained 30-mile-per-hour winds that are warm and dry, and they'll last for 5 months. Where our winds, anyone who's lived here for any amount of time knows that in the morning the winds blow up the canyon at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. They start blowing down the canyon, and by 5 or 6 o'clock at night, it calms right down.
Yeah. So I don't even know that I ever heard. I mean, were there multiple blazes in this area, or was it just one huge, gigantic, enormous fire?
There were actually 4 separate blazes. The ones that made the news were 3. There were 3 very large ones that did most of the damage. The total acreage burned was about 140 to 150,000 acres. And then there's still no cause on it yet. It's still under investigation. But there is a lot of damage done.
Yeah. I mean, and what could have been done there to have prevented the devastation?
Well, just like Chief Hewitt was saying, we have this vision of living right inside nature. And as wonderful as that is, we do need to be careful and not have trees hanging right over our houses. When we have decks, we want to keep flammable debris from underneath those decks. Bushes right up against our houses are a problem. And then the type of trees that you have as well. You don't want trees that are heavy in resins or waxy substances.
Is that like blue spruce?
That'll get you.
Yeah, I mean, because we got lots of those there. What are some trees to plant then that aren't so...
So there's a rundown of the trees on our website. It's pcfd.org, and it has a rundown of all of the maple tree is the one that we talk about, the aspens, the willows, the more moisture content absorbing fuels that hold it for longer. And there's an entire list on our website that'll show you the different types of shrubs and trees, pcfd.org, and talk to you about what to do. Some of the basics still need to be done here. Gas cans stored next to the house, obviously, not a good idea. Storing your snowblower next to your house with a gas can. There are a lot of differences, though, between us and California. We're fortunate. We do have, these ski resorts give us fire breaks in our mountains, too. So if you look at Google and pull in on the Google map, we have a lot of fire breaks within the ski resorts. So we have some things in our favor here, but yeah, absolutely, we could have a fire start from a lightning strike and have to fight a large wildfire. There's nothing that says that will never happen here.
Did we have any local firefighters go out and help there in California?
Did we? No, we didn't deploy a team this year. They had, but they were not short resources. They had more than enough firefighters there. We kept our firefighters here to do their main mission, and that's protect Park City. I was talking when I made this appointment, we went and watched a 70-minute production by a gentleman named Dr. Paul Hess. And anybody that's listening can visit his website. It's theeraofmegafires.com. And he spoke to us about what man has done to our forest. We tend to look at a forest that's plush and green and dense as a very healthy forest, when in fact it's really not the way forests are designed to be. He showed us pictures from 100 years ago of some of the most famous forests in our nation. And 100 years ago, lightning strikes were allowed to burn. So Mother Nature was creating their own defensible space, their own safety zones. And nowadays, we don't allow those to burn. We're suppressing, as a fire organization nationwide, we're suppressing over 90% of the natural started fires.
So we're doing that, though, because of homes and
because
structures?
We have to. That is precisely right. There is, because of homes. There's no option there. So we will continue. But now, but the option here now is mechanical cutting and creating safety zones and a defensible space. And we looked at the logging industry for decades as an evil. And we're tending to go back into it and say that they have a purpose here. And they can help us manage our forests in a more safe manner.
Yeah. Now, is California managing wildfires differently than is done in the West, or is it pretty much the same everywhere?
So there's the National Forest Service has set up guidelines, and they work under a plan on how they manage their forests. So, yes, they are very similar, but there's differences that are unique to each area.
Okay. So with the cool weather, we're pretty much done for the
We tend to look at the fire season as when we get these cold temperatures and this. Yeah, we're done. But if you get a 50-degree day, and this is really a great time to go out and clean up your yard or pay somebody to do it, have them come in and just check the perimeter of your house. Go to our website. I'm not going to be able to tell you everything to do, but look at what we recommend and look at that first 30 feet. We will be there. I've talked to several HOA presidents, and they really want to get the word out. We're going to be visiting those presidents and helping the HOAs understand what they can better do to make their home safer and give us a better chance at putting out the fire if and when they do happen.
Okay. In the meantime, clean your chimney, check your smoke alarm and carbon monoxide.
Yep. We got to change the batteries, right? We just fell back, so it's time to do it. Carbon monoxide, I read a story again today about someone that died from carbon monoxide poisoning, a couple of people, so... Always get your carbon monoxide batteries and your smoke detectors changed.
Okay, Paul, Mike, thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Leslie.
Thank you.